Okay, I think we can begin. So, I was actually quite surprised. I was chatting to some people about some projects I was working on and mentioned that I maintained EasyTag the other day, and half the people in the group actually said, "Oh, I use EasyTag. I didn't realize you were the maintainer." So, as an explanation of what it is, it's an audio file tagger, like, when used to get your MP3 files from an FTP server, and they used to be all crappy with the tags and everything. It's something where you can tidy all of that up. It's a really old application. It was first written in 2000 with GTK1 by Jerome Couder, and he did a good job. He maintained it until 2008, but he became, he had lots of other things to do, and he didn't really do much after that time. There were loads of contributors, got lots of patches, lots and lots of users. Quite surprising, because it's not a very pretty UI or anything. But he didn't keep it in a version control system. There was no Git, there was no subversion, there wasn't even CVS. It was just tarballs that he dumped every now and again. Hosted on SourceForge, so a bit awkward to contribute to. Not really a nice bug tracker, all that sort of stuff. So some other people, used this and actually thought they'd help out. It was kind of rejuvenated a little bit in late 2010. There was a repository on GitHub. Some good patches flowed in that were in distributions and things. There was a release. Awesome. Wasn't really very much. A few patches here and there. Nothing major. There was some good discussion still in the main list. Someone came up with a GTK3 port, which people have been asking for. There was a Mac OS X port. Loads of good stuff happening. But the maintainers didn't really know much about the project. They kind of could barely make a release. They didn't really understand the autofoo. It didn't really work. So I came along and sort of picked up doing the GTK3 port, stripped out all the old stuff. We stripped out all of the old dependencies, so depend on the latest GTK2. That helped quite a lot, tied up quite a bit of code, rewrote the build system because that was all horrible, and took all of the downstream patches that upstream have been maintaining for ages, merged those, and made a new release. 2.1.8. Alongside making a new release, moved it to gnome.org because it's way easier to contribute to than SourceForge, in my opinion. We moved all Bugzilla and everything, so thanks to Andrea Berry for doing all that and Andre for doing the Bugzilla stuff and setting up mailing lists. That was great. Got, again, way more contributions. Loads more patches merged into master from outside people. It's looking really pretty good. I made a new website. The translations are awesome. We were really stuck with translations. There were really low quality ones. I had people, like German guys coming up to me and saying, "These translations are not very good." The GNOME translation guys, really high quality translations. So thank you very much for that. There were a few annoying licensing things, like it used libmp4v2 and it was a GPL application. libmp4v2 is an MPL library, so there was licensing compatibility there. So I had to get rid of that. A guy for Debian had written a patch to get strip that out and use taglib instead, so we've merged that. It was using libmpg123, which can potentially decode MP3s, so that wasn't shipped in Fedora, so we had to get rid of that as well. Adrian Bunk helped with that, which is really cool. We've merged total disk number support, which was never there before, so that's great. All the file I/O and everything there was horrible. It was using like POSIX stuff in a really nasty way. So we're starting to use gfile and things. I had a few Summer of Code students who were helping to port things to use gfile. So finally modernizing the code base after it had been sort of languishing for ages. Fixed loads of memory leaks. It's now basically Valgrind clean. Not quite there yet, but pretty good. Current state, you probably can't see it very well. Still looking a little bit horrible. It's primarily a GTK2 application. I did actually suggest on the mailing list that I was going to make this GTK3 only and take advantage of loads of new features, but they complained. They complained that I was going to use G settings as well. I finally convinced some people that maybe it was an okay idea. Loads more stuff planned. Windows packaging has been requested a lot. If you want to help, please do. I'd just like to thank all these great guys that I've already thanked mostly in the talk, and through you for listening.
So next one's going to be Zishan, our Vala fanboy, who thinks that writing libraries in Vala is a good idea.
I don't.
It's getting better. Now he just writes applications in Vala.
Actually, the latest application I wrote is in JavaScript. Hello. So what did we do in boxes since last year? It's Godac. We introduced it. That was the first Godac we introduced this project into. If you still don't know what it is, contact me and I'll explain everything to you, if I'm in a good mood. So what have we been doing? Well, relaxing. Fishing. Well, actually, Mark Andre didn't catch any fish in that trip, but anyway, he looks pretty serious about it. Gaming and some more relaxing. That's all. Okay, no, we did some work. Actually, a lot of work. A lot of work went into a lot of hours fixing all the bugs. It was a very fragile application at Godac, at least the last year. But now it's very robust. It's very much more efficient. There's a lot of UI fixes. The UI didn't look as much like the UI mockups as it does now. It's a lot more similar, and it's that therefore it's a lot more friendlier and looks much, much better. And as you know, every detail matters. So those bugs and all these stability fixes, they were the most important thing, and that's what we concentrated most on. Apart from fixes, we have some new features too. Search, both within boxes and in shell. You can now search your VMs anywhere, anytime you want. You have a Fedora box, you just type Fedora and then you hit enter. More customization options. These are two or a few examples. I think there were some more options we did add too. We added this auto installation of Spice VD agent and these drivers, which means that now you can have auto resolution. And when you install the box, you just the resolution changes automatically in the VM, and you don't need to do much. And copy and paste between host and guest. That's a very useful thing, and everyone wants that, so we have that too now, out of the box. USB redirection, you have a USB device, you want to use it inside your VM, so we allow that, and we have options for that. You can enable individually which devices you want to share with your, well, actually it's not sharing, but you say that you want the VM to use it rather than the host, and then you can disable it for each device separately. Smart cards. I'm not so familiar with this part because it comes from Spice for free for us, and there's some particular kinds of smart cards that we support, and we don't support all of them. Mark Andre is nodding, so I guess I'm right. OAuth support, we finally have this. Christoph was working on it for a lot, and he's still working on that, making and improving it a lot. And if you have an OAuth setup somewhere, or you have access to it from your work, you can now access all your boxes by just giving a URL of that, and you will get all your machines. Options to pause VMs, more product logos you can see, and help pages, kudos to our docs team. And I recently also added image import, so if you have some other VMs where you have an image, and you just take that and import it. Although an image doesn't tell us all the information that we need for a VM, so it might not work currently, or it might work. It's up to the image, like which architecture and all that. But we are working more on that, and we will have support to import and export VMs from VirtualBox and the VMware and all these UIs. So you can easily import your VMs or export to them. So that's all.
Thanks, Zishan. So next is going to be Dyke, who made the long way from Tokyo to Brno. Welcome to Brno. And his day job, he actually works on replacing libANSI and other ancient libraries. But he's probably going to talk about something else.
Hi. Sorry for my bad English. This talk is a quick update of GNU/GetText. As you know, GetText is a tool to help localize programs. That consists of two parts, the library part and tools part. As most of people know, it is a very it has a very long history. In the library part, it provides basic functions to fetch translations from database. That includes getText and dgetText, pgetText. But basically, this library is not necessary on GNU Linux systems because those functions are merged into the main GNU libc. And on the other hand, the tools are still necessary to extract translations from source code and also manipulate database files such as PO files or IMO files. As I said before, GetText has a very long history. It has been proposed 18 years ago, and it had been maintained by Bruno Heibel for 12 years. Last year he became busy, and I happened to take over the maintenance. And then I released two versions, and the latest version was released on last month. And it has some goodies for GNOME programmers. The main improvements of 0.18.3 is new programming language support. It has now support for GTK Builder and JavaScript and Lua and Vara. And also it has support for Python 3 blessed syntax format string support. So here is an example. With the latest getText, we can properly skip the confusing strings in regular expression literals, and also we can use Unicode escapes in source code. Yeah, and it's now also support Vara, and so now we can use multi-line strings in source code, and it can be extracted into PO files and easily translated. And also, it has support for Python 3 format strings. Usually, we use printf style format strings for translations, but we can use more advanced syntax of format strings and some tools provided by GetText can check the errors of the format strings. So we also have several features planned, and currently we don't have support for Unicode escapes in C and Vara. So recently Vara gets the Unicode escape, so we need to add it. And also there are some ideas on XML languages. So and also we have another workflows in GNOME project. Yeah, so many things to do. So thanks.
Thanks, Dyke. So next is going to be Niabik from Bangalore.
Hello everyone, I'm Nirbhik Chauhan, and I'm here to talk about using systemd to manage a user session. So I'm not associated with systemd in any way, except for being a user, but I really like the massive cleanup that systemd has brought to the system itself, and I'd like to see that in the user session as well. So I mean, there's all these features, and they're so well documented. To be able to know more about these, you can look at Leonard's blog post about these. I'll be talking about this, how you can use these in the user session itself. So now the user session itself has the same requirements as a system. You have services starting up, and you need to manage whether they're starting up properly, or what dependency order they're in, and that, and keeping track of how they are doing. So you run system like this, and it's all done. That's it. You run, and everything works fine. Well, not quite. What happens is that there's certain differences between the two, mostly because of X, but also because of everything that we've built around GNOME session and managing the session itself. So the first, I'll talk about a couple of things which are different. One of them is process management itself. So we do not, for instance, have any PID files for the processes in the user session itself. So we can't decide when a service has started based upon a PID file. If you have a dbus service which acquires a name on the bus, it's fine. You just wait for that and you're done. But for a lot of things, if you don't care, for instance, user DIS update starts up once, and then you don't care about that. And the window manager starts up late, it's fine. I mean, you'll get some windows without borders, but it'll come up eventually. But for some, we do care. For Pulse Audio, for Zorg, and for dbus itself. One of these is trickier than the others. It starts with an X. So for Pulse Audio and dbus, if once you have a fixed path, you can do socket activation, and it will start up properly. So this is what a user bus socket looks like if dbus is started up a systemd. But for X, we have this. And that's dependent upon the display variable, which depends on the free VT, and that needs to be found out by systemd before starting X, or started by X and then figured out later. So that's kind of tricky, and the way to fix that is by making X use a socket inside XG.MDIR as well, just like the previous one. So there's a lot of other problems like this, and Colin Walters is working on this right now. He will figure this stuff out, and then we'll know more about it later. Let's talk about some of the features which we'll get for the user session once this happens. So first of all is C groups. We'll get resource control. We'll be able to use Firefox and accidentally open a 200 MB SVG file and not have it grind the system to a halt, use up all your RAM, and you'll be, for 5 minutes you'll be banging your head wondering what I did wrong in my life. The second thing is VTs. Now right now VTs have a very minimum environment and they're not really a part of your login session. With this we'll be able to have you'll have GDBus, G settings, and other things which are part of GNOME itself work from a VT as well. You'll have display, you'll have a dbus available, you'll have a active session available, all those things. Besides that, you have session management and debugging, so you can figure out which services are starting up, which other services are running right now, what has crashed, why isn't Evolution working right now, oh, there's this thing which has crashed right now. And you can even figure out the dependency tree. You can figure out which service is taking the most amount of time during startup, during login. So you'll be able to figure that out, and you'll get more results in getting faster login times. So combined with this and the fact that systemd allows us to have socket activation, dbus activation allows us to have parallel startup, all those things put together, we would save up at least, I guess, half the time. I don't know. I haven't actually tried this yet because it doesn't actually work yet. But once we have that, it'll be all great. And that's that. Thank you.
Thanks. Next going to be Puya. She is, she's a OPW intern for GNOME. And when she doesn't work on GNOME stuff, she designs typefaces for a living.
Hi, I'm Pooja. I'm a typeface designer, and I'm also an OPW intern working on GNOME's UI font, Cantarell. And even though I'm giving an intern lightning talk tomorrow, I thought it would be nice to show you guys some of the improvements that you can expect in the font in the next couple of months. I will mostly be focusing on the improvements to script and language support, but I thought I'd show you some general improvements which should make some people happy. So I'm going through the entire character set of the font, looking at each and every glyph and seeing if anything looks bad. So in the next couple of months, you can expect most clunky shapes, things which don't look right, to look right. Before I started my internship, read a lot of criticism about Cantarell's bold weight, more particularly the fact that it was much wider than the regular and it looked, in some cases, nothing like the regular. So there's going to be a bold which is practically brand new. It's narrower, it looks much more like the regular. So if you look at the lowercase k, for instance, at the top and at the bottom, it's sort of different because there's a slight space in the middle, which for some reason the original didn't have. If you look at the lowercase a, you can see that the first shape is kind of ugly, which has been improved. So there's some things like that. But more importantly, there is going to be some improvements to language and script support. So I began my work with doing a small sort of research project where I looked at the sort of So I looked at how GNOME has been localized, and the 60 languages which had the maximum percentage of localization already done. I sort of sat down and saw which characters they require to be, you know, used on screen, and then looked at which characters existed in the font and which ones were missing. And the attempt is going to be to try and add all those characters to the font. And wherever I'm not able to do that, I hope to file some extremely detailed bugs so that later if someone wants to add, let's say, Vietnamese support, they know exactly which glyphs they need to add. And so there's no sort of, you know, hit and miss that you want to do Vietnamese but you miss five glyphs. The next thing is much better support for extended Latin glyphs, which means that as soon as I can get anchors working on FontForge, there will be a different set of diacritics for uppercase and lowercase letters, which will harmonize much better with them. Also, you know, make sure that the diacritics are hanging at the right place from the letter. So if you look at the lowercase r in the before image, the comma below really doesn't sit where it should. So making sure all of that is perfect and all the diacritics actually look nice. The next thing I will work on is Cyrillic. Even though Cantarell has Cyrillic support, it's kind of patchy. And the quality of glyphs, at least I felt, was really not up to scratch. So you'll see a lot of letters. I mean, actually, a large part of the character set has been completely redrawn to make sure that not only are the glyphs better looking, but there is better research about what each glyph should look like. And if all goes well and I work really hard, there should also be Greek-supported Cantarell by the time I finish my internship. And in general, I hope that in all the work that I do, there is a whole lot of research that goes in, and the typeface you have in the end is good. So, you know, if you look at the Latin, Cyrillic, and Greek scripts, they all look rather similar, but the letters aren't really identical. So you can expect things to be, you know, really well researched and make sure that each script looks like the way it should. Thank you. And if you have any ideas, any feedback on the font, there is a Hackfest on Monday, and I'd love to hear from you. Thanks.
Thanks, Puya. So next is John Stower, a Kiwi currently living in Vienna. Probably not enjoying the Austrian food too much. Doesn't show.
Sorry, I'm going to have a short hardware demo, so may we all pray to the hardware gods just for a moment while I get set up. Okay. Okay, hi. So I work in Vienna as a biologist, and we do behavioral experiments. And an important part of doing visual behavior experiments is understanding the latency and the time characteristics of the animals that are under test. And so latency is measured in an experiment, contains latency from the display driver, from the windowing system, from the way that you're rendering, and from the hardware in the monitor. So assuming we're running perfect software on our desktop computer and we can minimize the first three or two, we still have the problem of great variability in latencies in monitors. So to measure the latency, the component of the total latency that was generated by the monitor doing whatever image processing it's doing, we created a simple little hardware widget and some open source software to do that, and I'll just try and demo it here, but just give me a moment. The motivation is it's selfish, it's for our purposes, because if we're building equipment that requires buying 10 or 12 monitors, we want to try and buy the ones with the lowest latency that we can. So the point of creating this tool was to create it so others can use it, they can test the latency of monitors they own, and by the way, it works for projectors and everything else as well. And then hopefully when it's finished, you can submit this to some sort of database if you wished, and then we selfishly could query that and buy the monitor with the lowest latency. It's slightly faster than what we currently do, which is going into all the electronic shops, plugging it in and measuring the latency ourselves. Happening. Cursed hardware gods. Also unstable Ubuntu. When was the last time the USB kernel driver crashed for anyone? That's new. USB serial port, I mean. Okay, this time. So when you run the software, what you see is basically there's a flashing black and white panel at the top. So we measure black-white-black transitions, or we use black-white-black transitions to measure latency. And you simply take your hardware, which has a photodiode and some signal processing running on board, and hold it up to the screen and wait a while if it hasn't crashed. No, it's fine. All right. It's lower level than that. Anyway, show me. Come see me later if you want to see it not crash, because it was working 12 seconds ago. As is everything. Once again. All right. So this is not going to cooperate. But essentially, you you hold the photodiode up to the flashing panel and you get a single number latency estimate. And we're also recording like the precise shape of the rising and falling edge. And so that's kind of useful for us like as well, but is useful to a user. You just get a single latency number, like 24 milliseconds if you've got a good monitor, or 40 milliseconds or if you've got a bad monitor. So it's really interesting. If you want to build one, they're really simple. If you want to see it actually work, come see me in person. But check out the website. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, John, for showing us why live demos are a bad idea. Next is going to be Adam, who doesn't admit that he works for Deutsche Bank, probably because his code was responsible for the last financial crisis.
Right. So, hi, I'm Adam. I'm not a typeface designer, but I'll show you how to create a GNOME logo font. So, what do you need? You need your logo In this case, you can get the GNOME logo from the GNOME brand guideline wiki site. You can tweak it with Inkscape or edit it in FontForge directly after you import it. You create your font that you can then use with your application of choice. And if you want to do some funky stuff, then you can also create a MetaPost version of it with PSDO edit. So this is how it looks like with FontForge after you import your logo and scale it, tweak it, adjust the width of the glyph. Once you created your font, you can preview them, all different types of fonts that we have. With only 3 lines of code, you can exchange your bullet points in your tech processor of your choice. So you have your nice GNOME foot as bullet points. You can use it in LibreOffice presentation or document. And with MetaPost, you can create funky animations with counters, page counters, or just cut out, for example, the GNOME foot of your bitmap picture. The files are on GitHub. If you have any suggestions, improvements, just email me. You can try out the font or just create your own logo font. Yeah, that's all. Thanks.
Thanks, Adam. Next going to be Mitch. He's going to freestyle, which means no slides.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't bother. Hi, I'm Mitch from the GIMP project, so you will have to listen to me. So the topic of my talk is how to port the main image display expose callback from the old GDK way GDK 2 way to the GDK frame clock in GDK 3.8. And the underlying problem is that what do you do in your expose handler when you have something to render that is really hard and expensive to produce? Like you can't possibly do it in every frame, so you have a buffer where you cache the stuff. That's easy, so once you have the buffer, you can display it instantly. But what do you do if you don't have the buffer yet? So if you have to, it's a classical cache problem. Like, as they say, there are only 2 hard things. It's naming and cache invalidation, and that's exactly cache invalidation here. So what we did in GDK 2 with GIMP 2, we had an idle callback that would just go over this huge buffer that is invalid and validate it rectangle by rectangle. And after each rectangle, it would just expose it. And because the idle handler was running at a slightly slower priority than the GDK expose handler, this shit would automatically regulate itself. So after each queued invalidation of your huge image cache, the expose handler would run and would just flush the stuff to screen. So, and I thought, you know, that's very easy. So I just go ahead and port this idle thing to a GDK frame clock callback. Very easy, super easy, trivial. Tried that. Took me about an hour. And it worked immediately. But I had a strange thing that it just was super, super slow. So if you had an image like this from your huge digital camera in GDK 2 with GIMP 2, it would like validate like this. And in GDK 3, it would like slow, slow, slow. And I was just wondering, what the fuck is going on here? And counting the number of rectangles it was doing, and of course, at 60 frames per second, I had hundreds of rectangles. And I was just wondering, so what the fuck is going on here? So I thought, sure, each of these rectangles is validated much, much faster than in the 60th of a second, which is 15 milliseconds, or what was it again? So something like that. So I thought, I just measure the time that I have in one tick and pre-calculate how many of my small little rectangles I can render. So and if you looked at the GDK frame clock API, it has a lot of stuff with predicted time and predicted presentation time and whatnot. And I was kind of going mad and consulted Owen, and he together we added like a ton of printfs into GDK and GIMP, searching for the problem. And in the end, it turned out I was all on the completely wrong track, because you cannot possibly expect your expensive cache construction function to run in the tick callback, because the tick callback should just run as fast as possible. You have to use the time between the ticks and move your construction load of your cache construction function into the idle. And so I did that. So the entire topic I wanted to talk about is completely void and moot, because I'm not using the tick callback at all. So my lightning talk failed, I had to do it differently. But I can assure you that if you have to construct something expensive, don't do it in the tick callback, do it in the time between the ticks and queue and idle, that is at a lower priority than GDK priority redraw, and do it there in small chunks, and once the tick callback comes, it will flush what you have rendered so far. So I think that's about it. Thanks.
Thanks, Mitch. Next is going to be Beate, who is part of the local organizing team that organized this conference. So maybe special applause that we are all here.
Thank you. So I'll be showing, I have no slides, but I'll be showing you some videos. So let me show you what we implemented or what we added to GNOME 3.8 as part of GNOME Help or GNOME documentation for end users. It is getting started videos which were made by Jakub Steiner, and I added textual content for that, subtitles, and packaged into a GNOME Getting Started docs package. So this is a landing screen for the Getting Started videos or tutorial, which you can see when you finish setting up your GNOME system with GNOME initial setup. There is also one intro video that plays meanwhile. It looks like this. This is the latest version. There's also some cool music, but, well, it's muted now. It basically shows you how to run applications in GNOME Shell, which is probably most interesting topic to users who are switching from other environments like other environments. So going back to this guide, we have some three probably most important topics to show. When you click a thumbnail, it plays a video in a window. Below the video, you can see subtitles. All textual strings that you can see in the videos or in the subtitles below the video or in the guide in the Yelp window are fully translatable. So we extract them via standard tooling we have in GNOME, which is ITS tool and GetText. So just a quick look at the markup for the landing page. Here we have the thumbnails for videos. Here you can see the subtitles, the textual strings. We also use mallard conditionals to show a different version to users running standard GNOME Shell and to users running GNOME Shell with classic mode extensions. And all this is shipped in a single version of the package. Let me show you something from the i18n perspective. As I mentioned, we made use of implementation of the ITS standard made by W3C. So this implementation was made by Sean McCants for the GNOME platform, for Linux platform, basically. It allows you to specify context and transfer those comments in textual strings when you need to avoid getText merging strings in different places into a single place in a translation file. So, for example, in the guide, we have a couple of SVG files, which I could actually show you in Yelp. For example, the big thumbnail picture is basically a SVG file with some textual strings like the activities, the name, the username, and all these are translatable because we put them in SVG and make them and add the lock note information. So when we have, for example, T, which stands for Tuesday and Thursday, we have a problem because translators can't translate it, so we implement the lock note attribute in an element, and that way we can easily make the content IATN friendly. So I think that's about it. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Next, but not last, is going to be Rob Bragg talking about the Coggle editor. Rick, I'm sorry.
Sorry, I haven't planned this talk ahead of time, and I'm also going to be awkward and swap in my laptop quickly. Okay, hi guys. Rig, this is a project I've been working on in the last year or so, sort of part-time, I suppose. I'm a graphics guy, and I've kind of worked on kind of all levels of the stack, really, I suppose. I've worked from sort of silicon enabling for GPUs up through sort of kernel driver development, OpenGL driver development through toolkits and Windows systems and stuff. Helped with clutter a lot and currently maintain the Coggle GPU graphics API. Through this time working on various UI technologies, I've kind of had this mounting feeling, I suppose, of the fact that we totally waste this really flexible GPU hardware that's in all of our consumer devices, our phones, our tablets, and laptops and whatnot. And been wanting to try and see what we can do to try and take a different approach, maybe to take better advantage of that hardware. As well as that, I've been fortunate enough to work in an office where there are visual designers co-located with engineers, and seen the process by which designers come up with their ideas using one set of tools, and there is this big impedance mismatch and translation problem. In then communicating what they want and actually engineering that and putting that onto a device. So something I'm really interested in is trying to improve that workflow between designers and engineers. The approach that we're basically taking here is we're learning a lot, and we're stealing ideas basically from the game developers, actually, because these guys are facing so many of the same issues as UI developers. They do a much better job of using the GPU than compared to UI designers. And so we're building a UI rendering engine, essentially, which is shared between a visual design tool and something that's going to be deployed on a device. And the actual visual design process is going to be constrained by the actual capabilities of that technology. What it's actually showing here is the idea that you can also connect this visual design environment to a device that represents a device that's connected over the network, which should be sitting on the desk of the visual designer while they work. And they connect it, and as soon as they make changes to the animations and such things, then they should be able to get immediate feedback by picking up that phone and actually playing around with the responsiveness and performance of what they're working on, because there's no substitute for testing your ideas actually on the hardware that you're intending to deploy your interface on. So we're trying to optimize that whole workflow right from the very beginning, where you start actually prototyping the interface. And as it being a kind of game engine approach, we do for practical reasons, have to leverage algorithms and ideas that come generally from rendering photorealistic scenes. So you'll see that we're using depth of field here so that things further from the viewer look softer, and we've got shadows here. And this, the idea of this is to show that you have bubbling up notifications, and that the thing that's most recent is clearer. But that's kind of out of practicality, because researching GPU algorithms takes time, and we had to bootstrap the tool. In the future, we'd be interested in researching sort of non-photorealistic, stylized uses of the GPU as well, such as painterly kind of making something look like it was painted with an oil, with oil paints, or sketched, or all kinds of interesting things. But it's basically, this gives the tools. This would certainly enable you to shoot yourself in the foot in terms of pretty horrific design if you try to, you know, look like an immersive 3D user interface if you went overboard. But I think with the care and the judgment of a good designer, I think there are elements to be able to use it. Okay, so I'm out of time, but that gives you an idea of what we're trying here. And this is on GitHub, github01.org/rig, or just come and hassle me if you're interested in it. Thanks.
Thanks. Next going to be Frederico, who no longer has a Wikipedia page because he's not considered significant anymore.
Yeah, it was deleted because, how do they call it in Wikipedia? Lack of notability or something? Anyway. So, let me see if the timer in this thing works. So, 5 minutes, okay. So these days I am a, can everybody read that? Or should I make it bigger? These days I'm a fanboy of Jane Jacobs, I'm sorry. Yeah. So Jane Jacobs is one of the most important thinkers of the 20th century. She died in 2006, unfortunately. I've been trying to read all of her oeuvre, and let me tell you a bit about it. The first book she wrote, she lived in New York. She was born in Scranton, Pennsylvania, but she moved to New York City when she was like a teenager, I think. The first book she wrote, which everyone should read, was called The Death and Life of Great American Fanboys. I mean, Cities. The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And it's like the first book on urbanism that you should read. And it's probably the last one you will ever need to read. If you're interested in why cities work, why some cities work, why some cities don't, why some cities are pleasant to live in, why some cities are not, this is the book you should read. People who have been following me, my blog, will know that I'm a big fan of Christopher Alexander. Well, Christopher Alexander wrote the geometrical, mathematical aspects of well-designed places. Jane Jacobs wrote about the social aspects. You know, what's the purpose of a sidewalk? It's not just to let you go from the street to the shop on the other side of the street. It lets you keep people safe when people can watch them. So it's a very interesting book. After this book, Jane Jacobs wrote a few others. One, a very good one, is called The Economy of Cities. Well, if I keep writing, I'm going to overrun my time anyway. The next one was called The Economy of Cities. And while doing her research on urbanism topics, she started thinking, well, how come there are countries, right? And in countries there are cities. How come there are, even though you might think of a country as rich, like the United States, why does the United States have very rich cities and very poor cities? Or any other country, you know? So she, by gathering a lot of evidence, like anecdotal evidence from newspapers and economics papers and this and that, she was able to figure out that cities that allow for small-scale commerce and production
to happen in them are the ones that get richer over time. And I don't just mean richer in a monetary sense, but also in the sense of people being skilled, people being civil to each other. So it's a very interesting book. The next book is called Cities and the Wealth of Nations, and it explores why the traditional ideas from like Adam Smith and John Keynes, or Keynes, I don't know how you pronounce that, from why those ideas of macroeconomics don't really work in the real world. Macroeconomics is this big abstraction that doesn't really work in the fine details. So she tore that down, and she wrote a new economic theory based on actual evidence from the real world, and it's basically an expansion of his previous work, and it's very interesting. Many years later, when we had a lot more knowledge about the origins of life and ecology and biology and this and that, she rewrote her economic theory in terms of ecological terms. What's ecology? Ecology is the movement of nutrients in the living world, or the movement of nutrients and energy, you know? And it turns out that it works exactly the same as economies work in cities. Am I out of time? So you're telling me my phone is running slow? Okay. And the one of the other books she wrote is called Systems of Survival, and it's the book I'm reading right now. It's about how come the commercial system, or people who do commerce or production of goods like we do, they have a completely different moral system from governments and guardian type things. And it's a very interesting thing. I think this book allows us to explain why GNOME got very productive at some stage. And right now, I think GNOME is getting a bit territorial, and it should not do that. I think this book explains that. And, well, I'm out of time. Thank you.
Ran out of juice. So, last for today is going to be Jan-Christoph Borchardt talking about stuff that no one of us wants to read.
Right. So, I see a room full of people who care about their privacy, who care about services who treat them right, and data ownership. But who of you actually reads the terms of service when you sign up for a web service? Okay, really? So I want to talk to you guys. Because we're doing this little project called Terms of Service Didn't Read, because that's what we do, right? We see a new service, a new online service, we sign up for it, and there's this little checkbox, I've read and agreed to the Terms of Service. Yeah, check it and sign up, okay? So no one actually reads them, which is kind of a problem, because what these terms actually say is most of the times, not what we like or what we want. So this is an initiative to read the terms and then rate them on an A to E scale, like from green to red, just like the European washing machine label, for instance. We have a browser add-on, for instance, which automatically puts the rating in the browser. So we have some ratings already. So there's Google, for instance. Oh, let me zoom in or something. Can you see that okay? Or yeah. So Google is class C. It's like average. YouTube is class D. Let's see what YouTube does wrong. There's lots of thumbs down there. So we rate based on paragraphs. Or based on sentences, or based on specific criteria, so data retention, for instance, or if they can just delete your account, or if when you delete your account, they don't and keep your data. So, for instance, here, YouTube, the copyright license is broader than necessary, which might not be very good for you if you're doing videos professionally or something. Similar thing for 500 pixels, for instance, or TwitPic. You probably heard about the the Hudson River photo thing, or the Hudson River plane crash. There was the first photo of it taken was uploaded to, or it was tweeted, which means it was uploaded to TwitPic, and then there was a copyright by TwitPic on it. So the original owner didn't own it anymore, or the original taker of the photo, and that's kind of a problem, I think. Do you agree? That's what I want to hear. Okay, so TwitPic is class E. It's like the worst rated so far. We have DuckDuckGo, for instance. It's class A because it doesn't have tracking. It's not open source, though. It's that's also kind of a problem, but that's a different issue. Because we thought, like, yeah, there are open source services, but like, these are the services people use, so we need to rate them. And so, yeah, we have some more. There are some which aren't rated yet. We have some points, like here Facebook, we have some data points. So it looks like it's going to be a class C probably also. We're a very small team, only working part-time on that. We're completely non-profit. We recently collected donations and steadily working on it, but we need more, especially law expertise, working on that, and just people who want to read terms of service. So you, I guess, and you, and maybe there was someone who wants to read terms. I want to talk to you and have you on the mailing list and contribute to that, because, yeah, we just want to help people who, I mean, not everyone can read the terms of service. It's just like an unbearable deluge of text, like the, oh, right, fun fact, the iTunes terms of service are longer than Macbeth. So it gives you like an idea of the scale. So go to the website and I really recommend like just installing the browser add-on. It will show a rating, like a small icon next to the thingy next in the address bar, and you will know this is a class A or D service. And yeah, you know. Thanks.